Hey, fellow babies, welcome to another episode of Fans in Motion, the ultimate Night Ranger and rock podcast. Do we have a fantastic interview for you for this episode? Now, we've had Grammy winners, we've had Emmy winners. I mean, we've had members of bands, all across the spectrum. But this one, I think, takes the cake. This week, we got Mr. Ross Valerie from Journey. Just released a solo record in April, entitled All of the Above. I think this is the first time we've had a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on the podcast. I mean, we've had members of, Night Ranger, Rubicon, Whitesnake, Styx, YNT, Huey Lewis in the News, Flock of Seagulls, Warrant. All those bands should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're in my Hall of Fame. But this Ross Valerie, I think, is the first member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to be on this podcast. Great interview. For those that don't know, Eric Levy of Night Ranger has been working with Ross over the last few years, putting together the solo record with Ross. So we're going to go in to dive deep into this new record, All of the Above. Joining Ross and Eric is also Jacob Stowe. He's you'll get his story. He's a studio engineer, producer, jack of all trades. It's a really great interview. We're going to split it up, part one, part two. You're going to hear Ross talk about his Journey days with Robert Fleischman, who was the singer before Steve Perry. And who went on to record with Vinnie Vincent of Kiss. Ross tells some great stories about being on tour with Kiss. We get into the Trial by Fire record that came out in the mid-90s. That was the reunion record where they all got back together. He tells a great story about meeting Eric Levy. And you get a lot of behind the scenes of how a record is put together and produced, what it takes to have a professional recording studio, what it takes to record. And that's where Jacob comes in and tells some great stories of, what is needed, to have that, that professional space. We also will get into each of the tracks from the record. So listen, this is a great episode. Ross has fantastic stories. Of course, I know all the ladies are tuning in here just to hear Eric Levy talk, and Jacob has great behind the scenes stories as well. So, listen, I'm not going to talk anymore. Here is part one of the interview with Ross Valerie. Listeners, welcome to another episode of Fans in Motion, the ultimate Night Ranger and rock and roll podcast. Listen, we got some familiar faces sitting across from us. We got the one that everybody tunes in almost every week to see if he's on our Night Ranger podcast. We got Mr. Eric Levy, and Levy's got his entourage with him today. Levy, why don't you do a quick introduction of your entourage that's with you today?
I think I'm in their entourage, actually.
His, we're in his entourage.
He's wrong. He's absolutely wrong. I've been saying this all along for a matter of years. Hi, this is Ross Valerie. I get to play with Eric Levy and friends over here.
That, and that's how Eric Levy describes it to me. Is hey, I'm and joining, well, everybody knows Eric. Everybody here knows Ross from the great band Journey. Just released a great new solo record that we're going to jump into. And listen, the quiet guy there on the far side of the screen, Mr. Jacob Stowe. What do you? You're a man of many titles, I hear, right? You're like an engineer.
Resident Victim is the overarching label. Everything from the cables and USB ports available for people's phones down to mixing the music and helping them out with production and stuff and everything in between.
Well, don't be getting Levy's beers and shit for him. You know, don't fall for none of that stuff. Okay, you know he likes to talk big game. You know, like, listen, I'm a rock star. I'm a Night Ranger. I fell for a while. I'm carrying his bags everywhere for him, calling him Mr. Levy. So don't.
No, Eric makes a mean pot of coffee.
Yeah.
So Jacob, don't fall for any of Levy's rock star stuff. But why we're here is, you know, Ross has just released a great new solo record called All the Above, and we're going to dig deep into it. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, you know, you got a career that's 50 years plus, right? You know, I mean, somehow, right? You're only 29 probably, but
I think you can stay.
But you have, you know, this you have this illustrious career, and obviously everybody's familiar with that journey story and the train ride, you know, that it became, where it's just everything's flying, you know, by you probably at a high rate. When you think back to those days, was it hard to take everything in? I mean, what's some of those memories that stand out of that peak period from the late 70s and 80s?
Well, there's this one peak period from the late 70s through the early 80s that was, as you described, a whirlwind. It's like, what's going on here? But what we all realized is we were riding that big wave, and we were at our best as a band and as musicians, and the integrated way in which we all worked together. And we knew it. We knew it then. There were so many moments at so many concerts during so many songs that we'd look around at each other, and we knew that we were at our best right then. This was the moment. But it still moved very quickly. As I look back on it, it's like, who were those guys? What happened? Yeah. The bigger picture, though, was, I think, even in the beginning, when it was a different music and a different configuration of musicians, we knew then, as if we stuck to it and stayed together and evolved and adapted and continued with this focused, determined energy, that it would work. And it did. And there's many, many aspects to that, how and why that could have happened. But there was an intuitive knowledge that this is going to work, and boy, did it. And there's so many people that came in under the Journey roof, the long list of fine musicians and singers, and how it evolved and changed over the years, and how it continues to do so to this very moment. It says a lot for the brand, and it says a lot for the band in the way it changed and evolved, and more than survived, it flourishes to this day.
Well, it's timeless. I mean, that's the one thing about that music, is you don't listen to it and it doesn't fit. Oh, that's that genre, you know, that goes in, you know, 1978 to 1980, or that's hair rock. I mean, it's just, it's timeless. It doesn't fit a category. It's one of those records, you know, those records are one of those records that always sound better, like on a Sunday, right? Or at a cookout, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that, you know, is kind of speaks volumes of the the popularity, or how it's just timeless. But I think it's interesting too that you said you were cognizant of, you know, hey, this is passing by, let's take it in, yet it's still, you know.
Well, yeah, even if we weren't aware at the time that this passes by and things change, but we were certainly aware of the moment and how special it was. I mean, there's so many occasions, but just one in particular, walking out on a large stage in a stadium filled with tens of thousands of people. Walking out onto a stage is so big you can barely see the other end of it. And to walk out and to be totally immersed, totally just zapped by the energy of tens of thousands of people who have all got their lighters and are swaying to the strains of Faithfully or Open Arms. You can't beat that. And you can't forget that. It's just was an amazing experience, oftentimes over and over again, over decades.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. One person I'd like to bring up in that journey, you know, history, we got a lot of KISS fans that listen to the podcast, and Journey and KISS have this little connection where before Steve Perry, you had a singer, Robert Fleischman, and he eventually in like 86 does a record with Vinnie Vincent, who was a former KISS guitarist. Always thought that was such a little interesting period of the band's history. You guys are trying to go, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, trying to maybe become more commercial. You get a lead vocalist, Robert Fleischman, which eventually you guys replaced with Steve Perry. Just talk about that little time period of that change, because that change is, you know, deciding for the band to go in that direction, number one, but then, hey, we're going to get this singer and then replace him with Steve Perry. Talk about that, just that little bit of time period in the band and what you guys were going through and thinking and goals, stuff like that.
Right. Well, the first three albums, which comprised quite a variety of material, that which would be considered commercial or not. The commercial is a very broad term, and it sort of has a stigma attached as a description, but all the material that we were doing in the first 3 years, that did include a lead vocalist, Greg Raleigh.
Well, I think Neil sang a couple too, right?
There were vocals involved in vocal oriented songs, but the record company CBS at the time, even though the band went gold with each of those three albums, and gold in those days was 500,000 copies, not $500,000 worth of sales. It was the real deal. In spite of the fact of going gold with some very eclectic music, the record company goes, yeah, that's okay, but you know, we want to step it up, and we'd like to hear music that is more vocally oriented, more pop oriented. And so we went, okay, fine, we can do this. And the first transition was in trying out an additional vocalist beyond Greg Raleigh, and that happened to be Robert Fleischman, who was a very fine singer and a fine performer at the time. And that was the first experiment. You mentioned his relation to KISS. I didn't know that until a conversation we had here before the Zoom, but I have an interesting anecdote about KISS. In the mid-70s, when we were first out, probably backing up our second album, we would play anywhere for anybody and had no problem with that. We ended up, among other things, on a short Midwestern KISS tour in the mid-70s. We didn't know who KISS was, but they were a headliner and they kind of had a following. And this is when they were $17 million in debt to the record label and things weren't working. This is before they exploded. And we're opening these guys, you know, and the horns and the blood and the flames. And we're going, wow, this is interesting. But according to what you said earlier, I didn't know that there was a relationship with Robert Fleischman and Vinnie
Vincent. He replaced Ace Frehley in the early 80s. And then he was only in the group for a couple years. And released a record in 86, and Robert was the lead vocalist. And it's, like I said, it's very distinct music. I mean, it's like heavy metal shred stuff, but Robert was the singer on it. And it's got a following. I mean, there's still people out there to this day that enjoy that record.
And to this day, I keep in touch with Robert Fleischman, who's back in the Midwest, and we have really great friendship. Once in a while, I've seen him as I was on tour. I would have him come to a show in Chicago. And of course, we all met up at the Walk of Fame there in Los Angeles quite a few years ago. That was quite a gathering. Practically everybody that had been in the band or was in the band at the time showed up for that. That was pretty psychedelic. That was surreal to have those people under the same roof or under the same sky. Mm. But yeah, I keep up with Robert. He's actually a fine artist as well, and he still creates and records music.
Like I said, just always an interesting time period. You know, so you have the '80s, you know, Journey, basically, you know, breaks up 86, 87, the greatest hits. I want to talk just a tad bit about that. To me, that greatest hits, where again, I was born in 77. I was, you know, too young to buy the records and, you know, be into all that. But I remember everybody my age, you know, as we got older, you know, 13, 14, 15, being teenagers in high school, you know, you would go buy the new Motley Crue record or, you know, Warrant or eventually Nirvana. But it seems like all of us had that Journey's greatest hits. And I think, Levy, I think we were talking like that was your first introduction to
Journey Killed My Bot. Yeah.
You know, with, you know, that, to me, that laid such a solid groundwork on how we talk about Journey becoming timeless is, you know, after the band has broken up and isn't releasing albums, you have this greatest hits that just opens the door to a whole new generation, which was my generation and generations after. But one thing happened in the mid-90s that all of us Journey fans were happy to see as you guys got back together and you guys released this record here, Trial by Fire. And this is like almost like the height of grunge, right? Nothing can take down grunge.
Yeah, you had
one band could.
You had grunge. You had all these various combinations of very different music taking its place at the top of the pile. But as you were saying.
Yeah, just with this record, you know, grunge is at its peak. Yet all of a sudden, here's Journey coming, you know, back like a machine. And you guys have a couple hits on here. You definitely have the huge hit, When You Love a Woman. What was it like after being away from everybody, getting back together? You're a little bit older, putting together records. What's your thoughts on that time period?
Well, at first, it was definitely surreal. Here we are in the same room again. That took a little getting used to, just like, we're really here. But there are so many aspects of how we five, or at least those five people, worked together for so many years. It was very much like getting back on the bicycle. It really was. And for me, I'm very proud of that project. I'm very happy that everybody found a way to pull together and make what I think is a very great album.
Yeah, yeah. This was, I kind of tell people this was my Journey record because, you know, the last Journey record that was released, I was like 9. You know, I'm obviously not going to the store and buying that. But this time here, you know. Hey,
there was always garage sales. Come on.
Well, you know what? That's how I got a lot of my early Journey cassette tapes were at garage sales.
Good stuff at garage sales.
But this was the first record I could go to the day it was released and buy it and put the headphones on and you know, check it out. And a lot of times you get reunion records or whatever you want to call them, and you get excited and you get to the record and it's maybe, you know, disappointing to where when we got this, you know, it wasn't disappointing. It had that Journey sound, you know, it had that, you know, the ballad was everywhere. It still is everywhere, probably still one of the most played songs at weddings. But such a great record. So Ross, I mean, you know, you've had this career, you know, all the way from the 60s, you know, to present. When does this solo record, an idea of a solo record, come about? Is it something that's always been with you?
The idea of a solo record is really only recent in the last 3 or 4 years. Nonetheless, the material, and that's not all of the material that's in my hamper. Sorry, pal. Don't tax me. The material goes back decades, in part or even complete arrangements and songs. But most of it I had never recorded until I began in 2012, oddly enough, with Eric Levy.
So
And that's where it began, at least in earnest, in completing, finishing what I started. That's been my objective. There's all this music that's been sitting on the back burner or gathering dust that deserves to be not only completed, but to be heard. And those two specific objectives are to me success. This is not about a career and carving out my place in the music business and all that. And I guess I've already done that. This is simply finish what I started. Why wait? And so I began in 2012 with recording with Eric on Wild Kingdom. And subsequent recordings happened since of material that may be 10, 15, 30 years old, but it's time to complete these and to put them out there. And I'm very happy with having done that. To me, that is success.
let's talk
So,
about that.
the time in which I was overlapping my activity here at my studio with Eric and all these other fabulous musicians and with Jacob Stowe at the helm. And so from 2012 to 2020, I was overlapping my work with Journey on the Road and even in the studio with my work here. So it was a really great experience because I was taking the energy and the focus from one project and bringing that to the other, and it would compound. So, and you know, rather than just going home and resting and doing other things that people do when they're not on the road, I was back in the studio creating and really enjoying ping-ponging the energy of the two. But all of the above represents just some of the material that I'm bringing forward. So it's not the whole story. I've continued to record with these gentlemen and other fine musicians ever since basically the lockdown ended. So there is more to go. That's not the whole story. And all of the above definitely represents no genre whatsoever. Everything. Here it is. Pick a card.
Let's go back to the beginning of all the above. 2012, you decide that's when you're kind of, you know, hey, I'm going to push forward with getting this completed and heard. So you, how did your paths cross with Eric?
I've got a great story. Okay. In around 2011, Journey had brought Night Ranger out as the opener for a US tour, and it was substantially long, as I may recall. And Jack goes, Ross, come here. Come backstage. Come to the dressing room. I want you in, want to introduce you to our new keyboard player. I'm going, well, okay. All right. We go to the store. There's a little room and a little door, and it's kind of dark in there. And there's this guy in all this black leather and this knit beanie and this braided beard and Ray-Bans. And he's facing the other side of the room as we're walking in the door. And Jack goes, hey, Eric, this is Ross. Say hello. And he kind of goes, yeah, okay, how are you? And I've just met baddest biker that plays keyboards ever. It's like, whoa, okay, it's good to meet you, Mr. Levy, kind of thing. It's like, all right, okay. Well, as the tour progressed, there was a night off that we all shared the same hotel, and there were a bunch of us from both bands of both staffs and crew hanging out in a lounge, and there was nobody else in the hotel. So we owned the lounge. It was nice and quiet. There was no elevator music going. People are mingling and drinking and visiting. And I saw Eric get up and walk over to a grand piano that was very lonely. He lifts the lid, pulls out the bench, and starts playing every jazz standard you could imagine. He even took requests from me. That's when I discovered the talent of this gentleman sitting next to me. And what a broad spectrum of styles of music he had. And I went, oh, I think maybe he might want to come over and try recording my first song with me, which was Wild Kingdom. And it was done not far from here in a different studio with the engineer I had been working with, however seldom, Tom Sice, who passed away a few years ago. But Tom got Eric and I kickstarted with the basics for this first song, Wild Kingdom. And that's where the relationship with Eric developed. Then I discovered his background in Garaj Mahal.
The mighty Garaj Mahal.
That's pretty scary. Okay. Yeah. Anyhow, my understanding of what Eric was capable of as a writer or as a musician, as a keyboard player, expanded further. So we've spent a lot of time. I've been throwing over the years now, I've been throwing song ideas at him, however vague or incomplete. He remembers these things so that when we go back to develop a song, he already has the ears for it. And I'm pretty amazed by that. I don't have that talent.
Yeah. You're right.
But so he's sort of a librarian, but as things developed from the basics of Wild Kingdom on, is where I needed to find someone to fill in for Tom Sice, and I was very lucky to have found through a friend of mine who runs a local music store that one of his employees who's working the floor is actually a capable, certified engineer. So not long after that, Jacob Stowe came on board. And what we have is the three of us working together, producing this music. But you're asking about Eric Levy. That's how I got introduced, and that's how things got kickstarted.
Well, it's like, and you're putting together a team. And I mean, Levy's a pretty modest guy, believe it or not. And it's like, you know, I think that hearing Levy and, you know, wanting him to be on board, that speaks volumes because, you know, who have you had play keyboards with you? Greg Raleigh, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Jonathan Cain,
yes,
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and then Eric Levy. That's, you know, I mean, like Eric, I mean, I think that speaks to your talent, that you, you know, follow in that line of talent. And then, talking about, you know, grabbing and getting Jacob on board. And you said Tom Sice, and that's Size.
Yes, Tom had been a well-known and acclaimed a recording engineer here in the Bay Area. He had his own business, which was called Tomland. So there's the relationship of the title to my honoring Tom Sice. Tom worked with everybody. He's did most of Greg Raleigh's album work. He did Mr. Big. He was the second engineer on at least two Journey albums and the recording engineer for one Journey album that was not released. So
Y&T.
And Y&T, Yesterday.
Well,
and he's
yes.
Got, if you look at his discography, it's a couple of pages.
Well,
he did like Count Basie remix.
Remixes of
Count
Basie,
right?
You tell him.
Oh yeah,
what's,
his,
what, what's crazy is, you know, is Eric, you know, gave me a little bit of history on him, and I just happen to be categorizing some of my Night Ranger records, and I'm in the Big Life album, you know, putting those together. And whose name did I see on the credits as I'm putting a sleeve in? Tom Wise. Tom Size. But yeah, he engineered the helped engineer the Big Life record of Night Rangers. So it was just kind of ironic that, you know, you guys have that connection even with Night Rangers. So you guys, you know, you get this team together, you're putting together what will become All of the Above. Jacob, what do you run into when you're trying to, you know, get these sounds that, you know, they hear in their head? Just talk to me a little bit about what your job is and what you do, you know, getting, you know, what they're producing, you know, as to a final product to where, you know, you can listen to.
That's a big one.
Go ahead.
But from the beginning where things started, we were doing a lot of kind of digging through data and hard drives and sessions, going back through work that Tom had done. And at this point, Tom was unable to, you know, be out of the house. He was, you know, he was incapacitated. And you know, it started from basically, you know, having to learn what Tom was doing in the room since he kind of put the place together, and how he was working it within the recording sessions to kind of pull up what they were trying to continue, which is kind of where everything started. You know, it was continuing work that had already begun. That was Wild Kingdom and a different version of Touched Part One, which hasn't been heard yet. So Touched Part Two is on the album, which came out of what we started working on back in the day. And a major situation occurred that we will not get into, but you know, it's worth mentioning that when we started working, we realized that we had pretty major issues with power in this building. We were basically unable to do any work, any productive work, because Ross at the time was favoring a bass with a single coil pickup. And we had massive problems with RF interference and all kinds of hum issues with the wiring in grounding. The facility. Yeah. And Ross was about to go out on the road, and we brought in Steve Jarvis, who has been instrumental in pretty much everything around here since. And he then brought in a guy named Dennis Stearns, who was a studio builder in the area for a very long time. And we rebuilt everything while he was out on the road, pretty much, and then some.
With a master electrician, acoustic engineering, and a Meyer system that was tuned to the room. It was quite a change from what I had before. So
yeah, it was a full overhaul. So that kind of formed the foundation and like the ground for everything after that. We started recording everything here in house, and it went on like that for many years. And obviously things have progressed, and I've learned a lot, and we come up with new ways to make sounds all the time. You know, as of late, it's been quite experimental. He's a madman with keyboards and guitar pedals, if anybody hasn't noticed. So that gets pretty crazy, making textures and stuff. And Ross is becoming quite the whiz with pedals and technology in his bass playing as well.
There's a segue. I could probably help cap this particular subject too. But having been a bass player who chose purposely to use just one instrument for a concert and maybe a chorus pedal, things have definitely changed in that regard. But But in terms of what the three of us are doing here, it's all in-house and has been all the recording, all of the mixing, with the exception of the basics for Wild Kingdom, done in this facility. And very happy to have the help of Steve Jarvis and Dennis Stearns and the master electrician, Tommy Thompson. Yeah. And we've taken a basic warehouse and made it into a fairly full featured facility. And so everything that everyone is hearing comes from this humble little building.
You mentioned that, you know, some of these ideas for these tracks go back for decades.
Yeah.
When you have this technology, let's say you recorded something in the 70s and now you're wanting to do it now, is it something that you're having to, you know, re-record because of the outdated technology? Are you able to grab what you recorded decades ago and somehow still use it? You know, explain that process a little bit.
Those are very good questions. One has to do with what are the styles of these songs? Some of them are not trendy. They're not now. They're not what people are listening to, but they have their value from that time period. And for me to bring it forward, you could say this is my diary, but I think they're worthy to be heard to this day. Technologically, there are two songs on the album that I brought forward from a prior project in this same building, but in a different unit that I was working with George Tickner, original guitarist and writer with Journey, and a man named Steve Roseman, keyboard player. And we had a project going for several years. It was more like an artist workshop, but I was able to compile and complete mixes of our work. And I drew two songs from that collection and brought them forward. One being Nightflower, of which George and Steve and I are co-writers. George appears on guitar in that song. We happen to have had Steve Smith in town who cut the drums for it. And I took the basic tracks and developed it further with Eric Levy on pianos and synthesizers. And Steve Roseman's parts were the string arrangements on synthesizers. And I brought in Mark Russo of the Doobie Brothers to cap it off. The other song, to answer your question, there was no technological issue in bringing forward older recordings because they were recorded well and in the proper way by, in this case, Tom Sise, who completed that project for me and helped compile and mix and master. So we have the masters to draw on and Jacob learning not only what Tom's style of engineering for these songs were, but he brought his own knowledge, which doesn't really comprise current approach, current techniques. So Jacob is as much retro as he is current day. He likes reel to reel. He likes those things that go around. Go ahead, Eric.
Jacob's one of these guys who it's like, he's so bright, you know, it's like he could do pretty much anything. And that's why he does so much around here. Cause he's, I can do that. And cool, you do that.
Okay.
But like,
okay.
When we first brought him in here, it was like, you know, this place had hardly any infrastructure whatsoever. And all we knew were the RF problems. And Tom had just passed. And so we meet Jacob and it's like, here you go, dude. Like, welcome to the building. So you can fix all this. And we got like all these tracks from everywhere. And like that you'd brought up Touched earlier, there was the solo bass on that. I managed to hit record while Ross didn't realize.
Yeah, I was over in the corner here just formulating these finger picking underlying bass parts and he hit the record button.
But meanwhile, like Jacob wasn't there that night. And so I got just like, you know, this like really messed up, crappy signal of bass. And we're like, here, dude, can you fix this? And he's like, yeah, let's go to 25th Street. And what all did you do? You like reamped how many times?
I don't remember. Oh, man. On that particular, I mean, there was, it was such a stretched out kind of thing that things changed in other areas along the process of recording everything. So like, yeah, what Ross was doing on the bass kind of was developing, like in terms of your sound and your like consistencies in your tone and stuff were kind of like becoming a thing and kind of something that you were like really interested in over the course of things. So by the end, like you were kind of, you know, your, the bass tone was a lot more kind of steady and consistent.
Yeah, distinct.
And yeah, everything kind of was just because it went for so many years that.
Yeah, there, in terms of the building, definitely had to make some improvements, and for the most part by Jacob's prescription. What do we need? Okay, let's get it. Let's do it. And then in terms of music, a few things, a few songs, maybe one song needed help only because of the way it was spontaneously recorded. But the majority of the material is recorded and or built from the ground up with the right expertise and technology. I would like to think that many of the songs on the album approach audiophile quality. In other words, people, if you have a good sound system, put it up on that. You know, you don't have to turn it up loud, just put it there. You're going to hear a lot more. There's a lot of detail that we have in this material that Jacob has gone to the trouble to exhibit.
And in, and as far as Eric and the keyboards of, on that record go, there is absolutely no MIDI whatsoever in the making of that record. There is, everything is played live. There was very little. The only MIDI that was involved was when we resampled some double bass bow sounds to make drones in one of the soundscape sections. And that was it. There was no MIDI recording. And we would lose our minds if we had to if we recorded all of Eric's MIDI. The computer probably wouldn't even keep up with his fingers, to be completely honest. So it's good that we don't do it, because it would probably cause a lot more Pro Tools crashes.
So why did it
Hey, how was that for part one, right? What about these stories? Kiss, Trial by Fire. I love the story about him meeting Levy. So great stuff. All this is going to extend into episode or part two, where we're going to dig even more into the new record, All the Above. So it'll be released here in 2 weeks from the release date of this. So check it out. Listen, if you're listening to this, watching this, go click subscribe and follow and all that malarkey. I know you hear it on all the other podcasts, but I mean it. Okay. Listen, go to, if you're on YouTube, click subscribe. If you're on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Tunes, whatever the hell it is, click follow and subscribe. We're on Instagram. We're on Threads, Twitter, X, whatever the heck it is. Follow all those. And then the hub is the Fans in Motion Facebook page. Go there, go to Facebook, type in, search Night Ranger Fans in Motion, click join. If you have questionable character, I will accept you into the group and all will be well. All right, guys, I appreciate you tuning in. Keep an eye out for part two. Until then, later.